AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction.
You probably already know that there are currently over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage. If you're a farmer, that gives you over 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support ethanol. Learn more at poet.com/ag. After posting solid gains last week, corn and soybean futures pushed to new highs overnight. January beans traded to $12 in the overnight session. How might trade play an even bigger role in the ag markets in 2021? We'll find out after an update from the world of used machinery.
Live from glorious Flory Morning via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with Machinery Pete, Greg Peterson. Then it's on to Bill Bryant, the founder and chairman of Bryant Christie Inc. And in the final segment, Dr. Greg Tilka, nematologist from the Iowa State University. And right after the news, Michael Clark from BAMWX. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson. And now, at long last, the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
All right, Davis. At long last. Good grief. It was a week, dude. It's fine. It's all okay.
That's it?
That's it.
I actually would like to express my feelings in song, if I might, quickly.
Oh. Don't you remember you told me you'd host a Flory? You said you'd be coming back this weekend, Flory. Flory, 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 oh, Flory.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Woo! Thank you, Edgar Candy. Appreciate that.
Feels
wow,
good
Davis.
To get that off my
Thank
chest.
You.
Yes.
Thank you.
We
like
almost
that.
Completely derailed last week. I don't know if you had the chance to pay attention to the show or not.
I heard something about the guitar talk.
It happened. Yeah. And it just wouldn't stop. And as you know, okay, I'm here to just sort of make sure everything goes okay to some degree. But
right.
Even with the guest host. As handsome as I am, as a sidekick, my powers are limited, Chip. I've got to follow the flow of the show. It's my job.
I understand. And hey, those guest hosts, they get to set the agenda on what's going to be talked about. And if it's guitars, it's guitars, I guess.
Well, and I was surprised. I mean, I thought, and maybe just all the people who didn't care turned their radios off early.
Yeah.
But people were responsive. They're like, well
I'm sure.
I'm sure. And nobody even mentioned Neil Schoen. I can't even start the conversation again over. Please take us somewhere else. Get us out of here, Chip. We need you.
If we're going to go someplace else, I will say that over the weekend, I did see a football game that was known as Farmageddon.
And, Farmageddon.
It went my Cyclones way this time. That was a fun game to watch if you're a Cyclone fan. If K-State, not so much. Sorry, Creed.
We expect you and Dr. Greg Tilka, nematologist, to be gloating a little bit today? A little gloatationist?
Not gloating. Mm-hmm. Uh-uh. Basking, we might have a quick conversation
perhaps?
About it. Yep. All right, man. Let's get to it. What you got in the news?
Chip, IHS Market Composite Eurozone Purchasing Managers Index of 45.1 for November confirms a downward trend in European economic activity this autumn. It measures to contain a second surge in COVID-19 infections have forced many businesses in the bloc's dominant service sector to limit operations. The damage caused by the second wave of lockdowns is expected to be less severe than that of the first. However, the region is still on track for its first double-dip recession in nearly a decade, which few economists had expected earlier this year. We had, you know, for a while there, we were like, oh, yeah, V-bottom, no problem.
Right.
At that point, we weren't even thinking second round.
Well, you know, the conversation early on was, is this going to be a V? Is it going to be a W? Mm-hmm. Could it be a K-shaped recovery with
a hockey stick was mentioned? Yeah.
Hockey stick was mentioned. Yep. And the K-shape being a split recovery, depending on which economic class you're in. And nobody wants to see anything like that happen. But this W, the W-shaped recovery is getting more and more talk now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on Friday backed Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's proposal to use $580 billion that was allocated for Federal Reserve loan guarantees, small business aid, and other virus relief programs that is unspent. McConnell said, quote, Congress should repurpose this money toward the kinds of urgent, important, and targeted relief measures that Republicans have been trying to pass for months, but which Democrats have repeatedly blocked with all or nothing demands.
Interesting that Mnuchin is back into this. And the only reason I say that is because President Trump and the White House had said that they are going to back away from it, and it's going to be up to McConnell and Pelosi to work it out. But Mnuchin's back in the middle of it.
Some wildfire and hurricane indemnity program plus, that's WIP plus, application approvals and payments have been temporarily delayed as USDA goes through what is known as reapportion funding and is awaiting approval from the Office of Management and Budget. Once that process is complete, applications will be approved and paid. And Chip, ARC IC payments have been delayed after the FSA attempted to automate the process, later finding a glitch in the software. Payments will be delayed until the glitch is fixed. I don't like the sound of that. It didn't go well.
They were trying to get those individual ARC payments out there a little bit quicker than December, but it's going to be December again. That's when they've always gone out, but this one's a little bit later than planned.
Well, the White House is close to issuing a list of 89 Chinese aerospace and other companies that would be unable to access U.S. technology exports due to their military ties, according to Reuters. A spokesman for the U.S. Department of Commerce declined to comment on the matter. Such a move would restrict the companies from buying American goods and technology and chip. It could also fuel already heightened tensions between the two nations as Joe Biden prepares to take over for Donald Trump. And it feels like it maybe got a little quieter there for a while with the China tensions thing. So, you know, why not throw a log on the fire, right?
Right.
Why not?
Why not? Very good. Very good. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Hey, let's talk some trade issues when we get Bill on here in just a little bit, Davis. All right.
You bet. I can't wait.
All right. All right. Thank you so much. Let's get to Michael Clark, BAMWX.com. Michael, how are you?
Doing good, Chip. How are you?
Good, good, good. I'm watching that blob of weather out there in Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri, into southwest Iowa. What should we expect from that?
Yeah, so rain will continue to kind of move east, and then as we encounter some colder air, it will change to snow basically for kind of eastern Iowa, northern Illinois, into Wisconsin, Minnesota, and it will snow. It'll snow heavily for a time, but the thing is warm air is following that. So rain will work back in behind that. I don't anticipate a ton in the way of like travel issues or anything, but it'll definitely kind of look, you know, like a snow globe for a time later tonight into tomorrow morning.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's talk about some travel issues, even though it is suggested that we don't. A lot of people are going to be traveling later this week. What, anything to be concerned about?
It's going to be very wet, and there could be some stronger thunderstorms Tuesday into Wednesday across portions of Illinois, Indiana, the kind of the Ohio Valley. And then throughout the day Wednesday, if you're traveling in the Tennessee, Ohio Valley, Great Lakes area, it's going to be raining almost everywhere. Iowa, Illinois, just a big system offering up a lot of rain. So it will be a wet travel day for many. Drier in the central and western plains, just windy. But if you're going to be traveling anywhere, kind of let's just say the eastern half of the Midwest down into the deep south, look for plenty of rain to be accompanying your drive there.
Gotcha. You know, but boy, I tell you what, it doesn't really feel like we're getting into a major pattern change, though, are we, Michael?
No, just a wet one, and it's going to remain mild as well. Maybe some cooler temperatures next week, but nothing crazy.
Gotcha. Thanks, buddy. Happy Thanksgiving, man. We'll talk to you later.
You too, Chip. Thank you.
All right. That is Michael Clark, BAMWX.com. Okay, when we come back, it's Monday morning. That means it's time to get our dose of Machinery Pete. Greg Peterson up next right here on AgriTalk.
Right now, there are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage, waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues, like climate change. But exports are unreliable and have been flat for 30 years. So how do we utilize all that corn while ensuring dependable markets right here at home? POET is working hard to increase the amount of ethanol in the nation's fuel supply from 10 to 15%. Nationwide, adoption of E15 would generate almost 2 billion bushels of new corn demand each year, which is the equivalent of nearly doubling corn exports by increasing domestic markets that can't be taken away. That's 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support higher blends of ethanol. It's time for farmers to unite around E15. Biofuels like ethanol are the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture will change the world. Learn more about what you can do to support Nationwide E15 at poet.com/ag.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bayer. For a strong start, trust the tried and true protection of Corvus and harness extra herbicides from Bayer.
So, Chip, the guitar there is the one that started the guitar talk last week, isn't it?
It's all his fault. It's absolutely his fault. And it's not only that he brought it up, it was his highly controversial view, you know? And I'm not even going to say what that was. Let's talk about you, Chip. How was your week? Did you?
It was good. It was good. And
did you put a little meat in the freezer?
There is a little more meat in the freezer. Yep. And the way that the market's traded, I'm a little surprised that I, didn't receive a couple of offers to take another week of vacation.
It was pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah. We did well in the overnight too. Last night we did well in the overnight. It's exciting times. Exciting times.
That's right. $12 Jan soybeans in the overnight. Just touched it and then backed off, trying to work on getting back up there right now. But
Hamer talked me into a new deal on the beans too. Speaking of, did you hear about this?
Is that right? No, I did not hear about this.
I got to sing Journey when front month beans hit 13.
13?
Yeah.
What song are we singing?
He wants Don't Stop Believing. And I won't do the whole thing because it's really long.
That's a long song. Yeah.
It's a very long song. Yeah.
All right. Let's bring it.
Brace yourself.
Because it's starting to look and feel like that's got a pretty good chance of happening.
I should have said 15.
Yeah, you should have played a little harder ball there. Greg Peterson, Machinery Pete. How you doing, Greg?
I'm doing well, guys. If I could put in a request for Davis, maybe Stone Cold Love for Journey song. How about that?
Oh, yeah.
Look at you.
Power ballad.
Coming with the requests on the power ballot. Yeah. That's right.
I'll do that one at 15 beans. How's that?
Oh, man. There could be a whole lot of Davis singing on this in the afternoon show before too long.
Excellent.
Yep. Right. Greg, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you doing, Chip?
Doing just fine. You got a sale going on right now, don't you?
We do. Machine Repeat Cyber Sale runs now through November 30th. Just go to machinerypeat.com, folks. You'll see a little kind of a little sign up there. It's just machinerypeat.com/sale if you want to hit the URL. But, yeah, there's over 200 items. We're working with our dealer partners all over the country and got some significant discounts. I looked this morning. We've got 40 tractors, 7 planters, I think almost 100 combines and heads and harvest equipment. So, a little bit of everything out there. And again, year end, some dealers trying to move some of that excess inventory. So got some good discounts for you here again through November 30th.
Right. Very cool. Check it out. Okay. I'm excited to talk about this one. Whenever Mecum comes up, I'm excited to talk about it because it's a little bit of a different twist when we talk Mecum, but it's always a great sale to report on here, Greg.
Yeah, they do their spring and fall sales, have for years. You can go on farming in Davenport, Iowa, Chip. And it's fun to keep tabs on the collector market to see how it ebbs and flows over the years. And they had their sale, a three-day event, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And it was a tricky one for them because of the restrictions with COVID that, in the state of Iowa that just came down. I don't know when that was, Wednesday night or something.
Yeah.
So they were able to carry it off and have a very successful online event. So my pick of the week this week, I had to go to our friends at Mecum there. They had a 1977 John Deere 4430 that I wrote about last winter. It was a restored one. A guy in Seymour, Indiana owned it, Don Cummings. And if you were at Louisville at the farm show last February before everything shut down, if you were at the deer exhibit, that's what I'm guessing you remember.
Yep.
They had this 4430 in front of their new 1745 narrow transport planter. They were trying to show visually that it can be pulled by your older tractor. Yeah. And it was, in my estimation, the star of the show. And Don sold it Saturday, and it went for $40,950. A lot of speculation. A lot of people thought it might go higher. But even so, that's still the highest auction price I've ever seen on a 4430.
Wow. Wow. Another record for the record books there. That's pretty impressive. But it doesn't stop there with the things that make them. There's other items to talk about, right?
Yeah, you know, again, this trend of the 1970s tractors really being where the heat is, Chip. Whether they're original, you know, we're seeing obviously those go crazy when they show up low hours. But these restored ones, when they look made to look like new, are interesting. So just a few highlights from Saturday. There was a 76 model John Deere 4230 narrow front, just under 8,600 hours. That sold for $43,050. I think that's the third highest 4230 I've ever seen. Another deer, they had a 73 John Deere 4030 narrow front open station, just under 4,100 hours restored. That brought $39,900, tied for the highest ever auction price. And then if we flip to the red ones, 73 model International 1066 mechanical front, so unusual there, 6,000 plus hours restored, $43,050. And let's see, how about a 1206 front wheel assist restored, 67 model for $38,850, second highest I've ever seen. And then a gold demonstrator 1026 1970 model, about $37,800. That's the highest 1026 I've ever seen. So a lot of fun stuff there Saturday in Davenport.
Absolutely. And now we're talking about some tractors that remind me very much of my, you know, first time on tractors and you putting some of that equipment to work. And that's got to be some of the draw of the 1970s equipment now, isn't it, Greg? It just brings back the memories come flooding back on those numbers.
Yeah, it's the whole thing, Chip, honestly. If you looked, we posted it. If you want to watch a video of the 4430 selling, my friend Alan Hoskins with American Farm Mortgage sent me video. He was on site.
Okay.
And I think we had probably had 50 comments on the video. And a lot of people, that's what they would say is, yeah, my dad brought that home. And that was the first one I drove. And like you say, very common theme from the 70s models.
Yep. That's interesting. So I was listening last Monday, and I heard you and Clinton Griffiths talking about how busy this time of the year has gotten and how strong some of the auctions are performing. Are you still seeing that, Greg?
Yeah, in fact, Chip, it's only getting stronger. I mean, this last week, I've been doing this 31 years now and really blogging since our website went up in year 2000. And I don't know that I've ever seen a period where literally every day I could write two blogs, three blogs, four blogs about, oh my gosh, look at this planter, look at this combine, look at this tractor. You know, highest price in 5 years, record price. And mid-November is always a busy time of year. It's the time when I would sell if I was retiring. And right now, you know, we have a little optimism in the space, which is great. We've got Davis going to sing our Journey songs here, the whole bit. And at auction, when good stuff shows up, let me give you an example. So one of my good auction friends, Aaron Siefker, Siefker Real Estate and Auction, Northwest Ohio, had two retirement sales Friday and Saturday. Mm-hmm. Now, Friday, it was green stuff. So he had a 2009 John Deere 7930, 1,300 some hours, brought 135. Highest auction price in 9.5 years on an 11-year-old tractor. He also had a 04 7920 Deere for $97,000, second highest in 7 years. John Deere 4555 for $54,000, second highest in 5.5 years. So the green stuff sold great.
Yep.
Next day, Saturday, Archbald, Ohio, another farm auction, red stuff. 92 model Case IH 7110, just under 3,000 hours, brought 44, tied highest auction price in 5 years. So you could say, well, that's 30-year-olds. But also modern tractors selling well, like that 7930 the day before. You had a 2006 MX 215 Case IH. Now, this had higher hours, about 5,700 hours, but $57,000, solid price for those hours.
Yeah.
So, again, good, clean stuff is selling really well right now.
Well, and tractors in particular, right?
Tractors in particular, and again, I don't even have to really say it goes on set, but the price of new, is what it is. And so when these really nice ones show up, like that 7930 Friday, 1300 hours, 11 years old, brings 135, and yeah, it's the highest in 9.5 years, but if you're looking at that horse, we all know what a new one costs, and there just aren't many 11-year-old ones around with 1300 hours on a retirement sale, so...
Right.
When they show up, it just...
We've only got about 30 seconds. Let's get that South Central Minnesota in here real quick.
Yep. Our friends at Henslin Auction Thursday had a sale. Now, again, a little later model. They had a 13-mile Magnum 315, 1,765 hours, went for 136.5, highest in 2.5 years. And another Magnum for you folks, 91 model 7130 front wheel assist, 6,000 hours. Still brought 52.5, highest in 6.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, wow was right.
This is it's an impressive report there, dude. Thank you so much. And don't forget, go to machinerypete.com. The cyber sale is going on now through November 30th. What'd you say, Greg? Like 200 different items on sale?
200 plus items, a lot of great deals. Go check it out, folks. And I just wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving out there. Stay safe.
Excellent. Happy Thanksgiving, Greg. We got Bill Bryan from Bryan Christie up next.
There are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage, waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues, like climate change. Moving from 10 to 15% ethanol nationwide would result in almost 2 billion bushels of new domestic corn demand each year. That means nearly eliminating the need for corn exports by ensuring dependable markets right here at home while driving commodity prices to profitable levels. Biofuels are the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture can change the world. Learn more at poet.com/ag.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
Jeff Wilson, Pro Farmer Senior Market Analyst, is with us right now. Jeff, we got a lot of ground to cover in 2 minutes of time here. Let's start in the cattle complex because there's a big move going on there.
Sure. That story is we had a nice rebound late on Friday to erase earlier losses. And then USDA came out with a slightly bullish cattle on feed report showing placements fell to a four-year low last month, and the numbers on feed were lower than expected. So that gave us a boost. The beef market had already been improving all last week, even though we had a lot of fund liquidation. So today we're back trading fundamentals of strengthening beef and slightly smaller cattle supplies.
Gotcha. So hogs just following along, or they got their own story?
I don't think they have as good a story right now, but we're still looking for a seasonal low in the pig market. And maybe we have hit it, given how strong we are today, up another $2 after reversing losses on Friday. We still need to see the pork market start to show some improvement. But the slaughter numbers seem to be intact, so there's that fear that we traded last week about COVID shutting down plants.
Gotcha. $12 beans in the overnight. Wow.
But both beans and corn are trading below their openings right now at mid-session. And that's a little concerning. It just tells me that right now the market needs to consolidate the big gains we've had over the course of the last 2 months in both markets, and they probably need to see more confirmation of drying weather in South America to get that rally going.
Yeah, very good. And we've also got the wheat market trading to the upside. Looks like SRW wheat is leading it over there. Jeff, thanks so much, buddy. We'll talk to you again later.
Take care, Chip.
You bet. That's Jeff Wilson, Pro Farmer, Senior Market Analyst on Markets Now.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture, and is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. We're going to be talking trade with Bill Bryan from Bryan Christie after this industry spotlight. It's been a race to the finish for harvest. Winter is on its way, and it takes some extra precaution to keep equipment up and running in the cold. We're talking with Chad Christensen, a premium diesel expert from Senex, the energy brand of CHS. Chad, it's time to do a checkup on that fuel supply, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to be real mindful of our fuel right now with harvest wrapping up across the country and temperatures dropping. And there's still a lot of work to do on the farm. So, you know, your equipment only runs as well as the fuel inside of it. And so it's whether you're feeding livestock or wrapping up some fall field work or even just clearing snow, you know, winter has some of the most demanding conditions on fuel equipment.
Right. And what are some of the things, some of the issues that can come up in a fuel system?
There's a host of issues that we commonly see when Mother Nature leaves that door open and the temperatures start to drop. Equipment just won't start. That fuel filter blocking due to the gelling is what we're seeing. Otherwise, it's water has settled in the bottom of that filter, choking off that fuel to your system. And so ahead of these really cold temperatures, I think it's important to understand your fuel's cold weather characteristics all the way from your cloud point to the CFPP of that fuel.
All right. So what do we do as equipment owners to prevent those issues?
Implementing regular tank maintenance program to help eliminate some of that water and contaminants ahead of the winter season. And then couple that with switching to a winterized premium diesel fuel like Senex Wintermaster. This will drastically reduce any of those issues that we're seeing associated with colder temperatures. Wintermaster is built for the extreme cold. It's a Senex premium diesel fuel, and it's got blended in with a number one premium diesel fuel. And then it's injected with most of the complete additive package on the market.
Yeah, very good. Okay, where do we go for more information, Chad?
You know, you can talk to your Senex Premium Diesel dealer or visit us at Senex.com.
Excellent. Good work, Chad. That's Chad Christensen, a premium diesel expert from Senex. All right, let's get to this conversation now with Bill Bryant. Bill is the founder and chairman of Bryant Christie, Inc. And Bill, welcome back to AgriTalk. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's always fun to be on the show.
Good deal. And as we talked about the last time that you were on, Bill, Bryant Christie helps companies kind of navigate the waters of international trade, keep up with the rules, the regulations, tariffs here, there, everything else. And Bill, one of the news stories that we did not have time to get to at the start of the show were those comments from Senator Chris Coons from Delaware, who is a close ally of Biden, and he basically said that he doesn't expect a Biden administration to unwind all the tariffs and try to take us back to where we were in 2016. Is that how you see this playing out, Bill?
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard yet what the senator said, so I don't want to comment directly on it. But I do think it's right that, you know, we can't be focused on trying to go back to where we were in 2016. The world is a very different place than it was 4 years ago. And so we've got to figure out, and I hope the Biden administration is looking at this right now, how do we move forward? Let's not try and figure out how we go back to 2016, but where do we want to be in 2024? And when I say the world looks very different, we have largely left the field in the middle of the game in a lot of regions of the world, particularly Asia. And other groups have moved in. I mean, I think the last time I was on, we were talking about how we had really pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership with Vietnam, and the European Union moved in and negotiated its own agreement, right? And so now we find ourselves competing with Europe in a market that's really important to cotton and dairy and a lot of other commodities on the West Coast and the South. Now we find ourselves competing with the European Union in that market. Well, what happened just a few weeks ago? The United States had pulled out under the Trump administration of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, an agreement that was designed to contain China, because China wasn't a part of it. It was an agreement with us and the rest of Asia. China just negotiated their own.
Right.
And so now we have a situation where in real critical markets in Asia, we're not only competing with Europe when we didn't really have to before, but we're competing now with China in a way that we didn't before. And so we can't go back to 2016. We got to figure out how we move forward.
Okay. And what does that look like, Bill? What does it look like moving forward?
Well, I mean, the first thing that, you know, the Biden administration hasn't been calling and asking for my opinion, but if they were to do so, I would say the first thing we've got to do, and it's kind of boring, but it's necessary, and that's we've got to reestablish leadership at the World Trade Organization. if the World Trade Organization isn't working, all of these other regional agreements begin to go off on their own way and don't have the discipline of the overarching system. So we need to reassert leadership. We need to make sure that that is working. And then we need to sit down with our major trading partners, Canada, Mexico, the European Union, Japan, Australia, and figure out a common strategy of what we're going to do with China. And essentially, I think we got to tell China, either you start playing by the rules or you leave the club.
Yeah.
Because what's the purpose of having a club if you've got members who are refusing to pay their dues and abide by the rules?
Right.
So, but we can't do that unilaterally because China's never going to be seen as giving in to the United States. But China does want to be, or at least pretends to want to be, a functioning member of the international community. And if the international community is against it, I think it'll be much easier for them to bend. So the first thing, WTO. Then we've got to reassert our leadership in Asia and take back some of those markets we've been losing to other countries. And that means we've got to find a way, face-saving way, to get back into the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Okay. Bill, one of the things that I've said from time to time on the show, and I can be convinced otherwise, but boy, it feels to me like U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, if I was an incoming president, I would probably pick up the phone and ask him to stay right where he's at. Does that make sense to you?
He's a very tough negotiator. He has the American interests at heart. He is sometimes, I think, is more inclined to go on a retaliatory path than I would. But he's gotten countries' attention. And we now have, as we've seen, we've got China purchasing products again in a way they weren't in 2 and 3 years ago. So we need to have a steady hand on our trade policy. What I want to see in the next U.S. trade representative, though, is someone who is willing to not just negotiate one-off purchasing agreements, which have a lot of short-term glee but not a long-term gain, and let's start negotiating some long-term agreements that really provide exports for years to come.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And those longer-term, we're going to get back to talking about multilateral trade agreements, not the bilateral that the Trump administration was pursuing, correct?
I hope so, because I think that the bilateral agreements that the Trump administration were pursuing weren't so much trade agreements, and there are some exceptions there, but they were largely purchasing agreements, that we were getting countries to agree to purchase a certain amount of product. Hmm. And what we need to do is actually get countries to agree on rules that open up their markets so we can compete in there and sell our product, not just for the year or two that is covered by the agreement, but for a decade from now. And that's what I'm saying. Let's not try and figure out how we go back to 2016 and how much we were shipping in 2015 or whatever. Let's figure out how we can open up those markets and have permanent access and compete in them for not just the next year or two, but for 8 and 10 years from now.
Okay, so when you look at the list of allies, and I think you already mentioned this, Bill, but when you look at the list of potential allies with the U.S. in trade issues, what countries are you looking at most closely?
The first thing we have to do is really consolidate, reestablish our firm relationship with NAFTA. And that means Canada and Mexico. If you look at the resources of North America, you take the fresh water and the energy and the agricultural potential of Canada, you take the labor and the energy and the agricultural potential of Mexico, and you combine that with the capital and the labor and the agriculture and the energy of the United States, there is no country on the planet that can touch North America. So let's make sure that the three of us are in lockstep and then negotiate a more permanent, solid relationship with Japan and Europe, which we used to have and has gotten a little bit tattered. Let's put that one back together. If you have the United States, Japan, Mexico, Canada all on the same page with Europe, then we can begin to move against China, and not move against it, but consolidate a position that allows us to open up that market in a way it needs to be opened.
Okay. What about the UK? Where does Britain fit in all of this?
That's a really good question. That's a swamp or a thicket or whatever you want to wade into that the Biden administration is going to have to kind of figure out, because we have to have a very solid relationship with the UK on a number of levels, not just trade, not just agricultural trade. they are have been our key ally in the European Union. Well, now that they're pulling out, some people are thinking, well, they'll just come and they'll become part of NAFTA. They're going to be closer to the United States. Well, they really can't, because they can pull out of the European Union, but at the end of the day, the European Union is their biggest market. And they are really tied in and integrated with Europe. So they've got to figure out a way how they can be close to Europe without being in Europe. That's a little swampy thicket of itself. Mm-hmm. And then we have to figure out how we have a working relationship with both of them. Right. And I think really we should move forward and as quickly as possible establish a very solid permanent trade relationship with the UK and make it as close to a free trade agreement as they're willing to go. And I think in a lot of agricultural issues, they're not willing to go very far, not as far as I'd want to go. But let's establish that and then use that as a foundation to figure out how we continue to have a good relationship with Europe, because we need to have a good relationship with Europe.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Bill, as we start to make progress here on and getting a clearer picture of what the Biden administration or a Biden administration's trade plan will look like, we're going to get you back on here and evaluate it, okay?
Yeah, I'll get some more details, and we'll see how a lot of these markets kind of unfold in November. And
excellent.
Get back together again.
Excellent. That's Bill Bryant, Brian Christie.
America's Conservation Ag Movement would like to recognize Farm Journal Foundation for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
All right, Dr. Greg Tilka is an Iowa State University nematologist. He does work for the Soybean Cyst Nematode Coalition, and he joins us right now. Greg, how about them cyclones?
Hey, how about them cyclones, buddy? This might be our year, finally.
It's fun to watch them. It can be a very frustrating team to watch, but boy, I tell you what, there wasn't a whole lot of frustration on the field on Saturday, was there?
Yeah, no, I don't remember a more relaxing game to watch in my 30 years here at Iowa State than last Saturday.
That's
love it.
Exactly right. Exactly right. How you been? Everything good?
Yep, doing well, staying busy.
Good. Good.
And I hope same goes for you.
Oh, yeah. You bet. You bet.
Very good.
Yeah, so 2020, kind of a different year when it comes to the soybean cyst nematode and keeping track of them, because a lot of areas turned hot and dry on us there in July, August. How does that influence what those little buggers are doing?
Well, you know, Chip, older I get, the more, I guess, wise I get, and just seems like there's bad news around every corner with soybean cyst nematodes. We had flooding, you know, folks were asking, did floodwaters drown SCN? And the answer was no. And in fact, floodwaters could spread SCN. Yeah. So now we have the opposite of a flood. We've got droughts. And unfortunately, there's really sound evidence that SCN goes crazy in hot, dry soil. The reproduction is through the roof. And so I'm fearful for what's out there in the fields now and what's going to be waiting for the next soybean crops grown in fields that had soybeans this year.
Yeah. Well, first things first on that, though, right, Greg? And
mm-hmm.
I mean, figure out how big of a problem you might have.
Yeah, exactly. So it's difficult to talk about difficult things now, but it helps when you can do something about it. And now is a perfect time that farmers can do something about it, and that is get their field sampled. Get either out there themselves with a soil probe and zigzag their way through, or get the co-op or elevator agronomist or seed company agronomist to do it. Send your samples in to a lab and find out what you're dealing with. And you mentioned the SCN Coalition. There's a website with a national map, and anybody can click on their state and find the labs that test for that process samples. And the website is thescncoalition.com. But now is a beautiful, perfect time to pull soil samples.
Well, and in a lot of places, the soil conditions are perfect for pulling samples, too.
Yeah, you're right. It's no fun in the sloppy, muddy conditions to pull soil samples, and that's not the case now. And we're getting mild weather, mild temperatures as well. So it's a great way to get exercise, my favorite way to get exercise, and Why not take advantage of it? And it might end up translating into more money in the next growing season.
Okay, so we do the soil sampling. We get the report back. We've got a problem. Who do we sit down with first? Do we sit down with a chem guy, or do we sit down with a seed guy first, try to figure out how to limit the damage?
I've never been asked that question, Chip, but it's a great question. And no offense to the chemical guys and gals, but I would sit down with a seed rep. It all starts with the variety. And the base of managing SCN is resistant soybean varieties. And so you got to tackle that hurdle first, and then you can kind of add extra help on top of it.
Okay. And I want to stress that, because it really does start with the resistant varieties on the on soybeans, right?
Absolutely. And I'm kind of frustrated because almost all soybean varieties have the same set of resistance genetics, and that has led to the nematode SCN in everybody's fields having higher reproduction on those resistant varieties, and that leads to lower yield. So I'm really encouraging farmers to speak up for themselves and ask their seed dealers what varieties they have that aren't the common 88788, and what they can grow that's uncommon, because that's going to control the nematode better. And if the answer is very little or nothing, ask them why. Until farmers advocate for themselves, speak up that they need other sources of resistance, I don't think things are going to change. And the resistance we have is better than nothing. 88788 is better than nothing, but it's about 40% as effective as it used to be 20 years ago.
Okay. So the add-on approach to managing SCN, is it getting better?
Yes, it is getting better. The add-on approach is seed treatments, and the SCN Coalition has a nice handout that lists the 10 or 11 options now. And I can tell you from companies asking me to do greenhouse and field testing of experimental stuff that more are coming down the pike. The one frustrating thing about seed treatments is, in my experience, their performance, their benefit is inconsistent. Sometimes we see a 2, 3, 4 bushel per acre yield bump that will more than pay for the product, and other times we see nothing. Right. And I don't understand why those things work when they do and why they don't when they don't. And that's really the piece of knowledge we need to better help farmers, to guide them on when to use the seed treatments. But in general, we definitely can use them on top of resistant soybeans, because as we just finished talking about, resistant soybeans aren't cutting the mustard like they used to.
Right, right. And it's taken a bite out of the bottom line on a lot of these guys. I mean, when they talk about disappointing bean crop, a lot of times it's because of SCN.
Absolutely. And we do 9 main, very large experiments across Iowa each year. And I'm still sorting through 2020's data. But in 2019 in Southeast Iowa, we had a variety experiment where the difference between Peking, and which is the uncommon source of resistance, and the common PI88788 was 22 bushels per acre, which penciled out at the time to be about $200 an acre. Oh. If a farmer had grown beans with Peking resistance, he would have earned, he or she, $200 an acre more than the easy-to-come-by 88788 resistance. So that
Shocking.
Underscores... Yep, the problem, the dollar and cents of the problem.
Greg, great information there. TheSoybeanCoalition.com, right?
Yes, TheSCNCoalition.com. No space.
TheSCNCoalition.com. Thanks, Greg.
Yes,
Thank
sir.
You so much. We got Mark Gold this afternoon. Come back, everybody. This is AgriTalk.